Mr. Nafees Hamid, welcome to Conversation With.
Thank you for having me.
Have you actually got a terrorist to put his head into a brain scan?
We've never had a terrorist put his head into a brain scan. What we have found is supporters. Now, every terrorist group has a small number of actual operators and members of the group, but it has a vast support network. And without that vast support network, it probably couldn't do most of its operations. And so we have been able to find members of Al-Qaeda's affiliate, Luxury Taiba, their supporters in Barcelona. And so we got them to go into the brain scanner.
What did you say to them when you persuaded them, say, please come in and lie down here and we want to talk to you and we want to scan your brain? How did you convince them?
It took me a while to figure out exactly what was the angle that would work for them. But ultimately, I found just being very honest and saying, look, we want to understand you. We want to understand your values about politics, about religion, about social issues, and we want to look at your brain and we're going to compare it to other populations who believe things just as strongly as you do, and we're going to see, are there differences or similarities between how you think? And I think I talk to terrorists, I talk to supporters of terrorist organizations, and people want to be understood. Nobody thinks they're the bad guy, right? They think they're fighting on the right side of history. And if they feel someone genuinely wants to understand them, they're willing to participate.
Okay, so it had to start with your not being perceived as being biased, funded by, Western powers to somehow besmirch Islam.
Exactly, yeah. I remember I was talking to this one guy who was not part of the population that we scanned, but just a member of Al-Muhajirun, which is the biggest designated terrorist group within the UK, and about 50% of all jihadist-related terrorist plots come from that one group. And I was talking to one of the leaders, and I asked him, look, when I'm out there talking about you guys in the media or in popular articles, I use the word radicalization or radicals to talk about you. What do you think about that word? Do you find that offensive? He says, no, I love it. Because I am a radical. I'm outside the system. I have no problem with being called a radical. That's part of the identity, that they're anti-establishment, that they're rebels, that it's almost a sort of new punk culture that they're a part of. And so they like being understood and having their point of view put out there.
But what they do is not punk culture.
No, it's not.
Ramming a van into people, blowing up children in marketplaces is hardly punk culture.
Exactly, and they're very uncomfortable when you actually bring up the victims of those kinds of attacks. They have a way of talking about the victims as though they're not victims. I was talking to a Dutch member of Al-Nusra, which was the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. Now it's sort of separated, but at the time it was a formal affiliate. And he was talking about 9/11, and he said, that was an attack on economic infrastructure, and so that's justified in Islam. And I said, but there were over 3,000 people that died. How can you just refer to them as economic infrastructure? When you think about the family members of these people, the individuals that died, the innocent people, how do you feel? And he was quiet for a very long time, and he said, it obviously doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel nice to actually think about those kinds of people. And then they always say, but they kill so many of ours with their drone strikes. And it's always that whataboutism that comes back into play.
So they anonymize the victim to some degree. But let's bring the conversation back to the brain scans. For an ordinary person, we ask the simple question, so do terrorists have different brains?
Not really, but that wasn't even the hypothesis that we were testing, right? If a terrorist has a totally different brain, we should be able to see that psychologically. We should see that in the profiles, we should see that in our survey studies, that this person is just some kind of psychopath, that there's something totally wrong with them. And you don't see that. You see people from, they kind of span the normal distribution, if you will. It's what psychologists call the normal distribution. So you do find people with problems, but you find lots of normal people. You find men, you find women, you find converts, you find people who are extroverted, who are introverted, all different kinds of personality types. So the purpose of doing a brain scan is not to assume that there's something different about a radicalized person's brain, but to look within that person's brain and say, what is the difference between different categories of values within their ideology? We have a way of thinking of radical ideology as though it's impenetrable, that you can't even talk to these people because they're just so fundamentalized in all of their thinking. But that's not the case. There's at least two different categories of values that they have. One is called sacred values, which are basically absolutist values. They're non-negotiable. You cannot trade with these values. You cannot make people think about these values in any cost-benefit analysis way. No utilitarian thinking. And the other set of values are non-sacred values, which are basically just not that. So we want to know, what's going on with this other set of values? in the case of Belgium, and it wasn't even just the charismatic leaders themselves that were kind of doing this top-down recruitment. It was a co-radicalization process of friends recruiting friends.
So they're not understanding in a different way from, so to say, us non-radicalized persons.
Yeah, exactly. And just like normal people, many people have sacred values as well. If you go talk to an animal rights activist or someone who's an environmentalist activist, they have sacred values as well, values that are so important to them that they would be willing to sometimes give their life for those values.
That's a very interesting idea, or rather this phrase you use, sacred values. How is sacred values different from, let's say, a set of religious beliefs? Are they different?
Well, yes, they are different, because you can have freedom of speech can be a sacred value. Democracy could be a sacred value. It doesn't have to have any supernatural elements to it. It doesn't have to have any characteristics or any metaphysics of religion associated with it.
So it doesn't have to be related to any sort of God figure.
It's transcendent. It's sacred in the sense that it's closed off from being able to be mixed with any of the profane values of everyday life. A sacred value can even be just like a watch that your father, your dying father, gave you. You would never be willing to sell this watch, even if you were starving, for example. Maybe there's some people who have heirlooms or pieces of inheritance that they value so much. When there's a fire on their home, they'll run back down into the burning house to grab that heirloom. That would be a sacred value for that person.
Where do we, though, then make the crossover? So when you describe a sacred value like that, as you say, going to, you know, rescue your dad's watch because he gave it to you, it sounds good. But it's not so good if you say that it's such a sacred value that I would kill a person to get the watch back.
Right. Well, that's where the rest of the ideology comes into play, right? Which is that you have to have these radical groups, they have ideology that justifies the violence itself. But what's interesting is in that same brain scan study, what we find is that it's actually the commitment to violence that is somewhat malleable, that's negotiable, actually. So normally when you do research on sacred values, what you find is if you try to argue with someone's sacred values, it doesn't work. It backfires, people become more stubborn, they want to socially distance themselves from you, they don't want to talk to you, and you can't even be friends with that person. People will cut off social ties if they know that their loved one doesn't agree with their sacred values, which is why in de-radicalization programs, you don't really want to attack someone's sacred values. You don't want to tell them that their desire for strict Sharia is wrong or to want to live in a caliphate is bad. It's not going to work, they're going to close off to you. But in the same study, what we did is we gave something called false consensus feedback, which basically we said, okay, here's your value, your sacred value. Tell us how much you're willing to commit violence for this value. And then we said, okay, but this is what your peer group said about their willingness to commit violence. And in many cases, it was lower than their willingness. Now, at first we thought, well, these people are going to just, if it's a sacred value, they're not going to care, they're not going to adjust. However, people did adjust. They conformed to the social norm. They conformed to the peer pressure. And this surprised us because we thought, wait, these are supposed to be sacred values. They're non-negotiable. They're immune to peer pressure. However, the commitment to violence is not immune to peer pressure. It's the adherence to the value that's immune to peer pressure.
One of the things I found very interesting about your research was that it goes against the sort of common idea that we have that it's radicalization by strangers through the internet and so on that is actually the most powerful. But that's not what you found.
No, not at all. And if it was the case that it was the internet that was radicalizing people, we would expect to see even geographical distribution of radicalization. Because, well, at least in European countries, pretty much everyone has the internet. So you would expect, looking at a country like France, that you would find an even number of people from all over France. But you don't find that. In the case of Belgium, the country that has one of the highest per capita foreign fighter rates, one-third of all foreign fighters were recruited from just two people. They were part of just two networks that were recruiting people. And it wasn't even just the charismatic leaders themselves that were kind of doing this top-down recruitment. It was a co-radicalization process of friends recruiting friends. The messenger is as important as the message. So once a friend starts to radicalize, they'll go start talking to their other friends about these ideas. They'll start meeting in cafes and parks, in gymnasiums, in their apartments. And what you see is sort of an echo chamber getting created, where they start co-radicalizing each other and pushing each other over the edge.
And friends seems to be even more important than family. Family radicalizations are comparatively fewer.
especially in the Western world, that's true. You do see occasionally mothers and fathers, sometimes actually surprisingly mothers more and more, even in Morocco, you find mothers sometimes radicalizing their children. But yes, it's peer groups. Again, this is sort of where the pop culture, the youth movement aspect of this sort of comes to light. Whereas people do really feel like they're part of some anti-establishment, some kind of vanguard anti-establishment movement of our times. And that's what appeals to them, that it's transnational, that someone in the suburbs of Paris can be talking about the same ideas as someone living in Islamabad or living in Kuala Lumpur or anywhere else, and that they're all part of this clandestine network, sharing ideas, sharing these sentiments, but ultimately radicalizing in a very local way. That's part of what makes it subversive and cool and underground, and that's why it's so contagious at a friend-to-friend level.
So you have these two powerful ideas, that sacred ideal, and then this friend network, the peer group.
Exactly.
And put together, that really sucks them in.
And we find that even in our survey studies, we find what's called an interaction effect. Basically, when people have sacred values, and they're part of what we call a fused group of friends, where basically you look at your network as friend, your network of friends as almost an extension of yourself. And when that very tight-knit network of friends starts sharing these values, what they're doing is they start increasing the sacralization of these values by talking about them all of the time. And then when they're willing to go and commit violence or fight and die for their values in any way, they're not always doing it just for the values themselves, but it's also about fighting for their friends, fighting for the guy next to them, which is something you hear from traditional militaries as well. When we talk to US soldiers and we say, what is it that makes you willing to give your life on the front lines of a war? Is it the big values? Is it the American flag? Is it liberal democracy? They say, no, I'm fighting for the guy next to me.
If you talk about things like, animal rights, are we seeing the very same kind of ideas in us? They, again, as you say, have a sacred value, plus they have a strong network. And that can push you over to wanting to act violently?
Well, I don't know if it's going to push you over to act violently. What it will push you is your willingness to commit what we call costly sacrifices. So even Nelson Mandela committed costly sacrifices. Mahatma Gandhi committed costly sacrifices. Martin Luther King committed costly sacrifices. Pacifist activists all over the world are committing costly sacrifices. They're allowing themselves to be beaten by police officers, to be imprisoned. They go on hunger strikes. They may be doing violence to themselves, but they're not necessarily doing violence to other people. That's more part of the ideology of the movement.
How can your work, your studies, actually inform de-radicalization?
I'm skeptical of even the term de-radicalization.
How can your work, your studies, actually inform de-radicalization?
Well, I'm skeptical of even the term de-radicalization. I think we can disengage people from terrorist groups so that way they're no longer wanting to give their life for it. But even if you are able to pull some people who are not that, let's say, strongly believing in the ideology, young people who sort of naively got involved because they thought they were going to be freedom fighters in Syria and then they fell into the hands of ISIS and they came back and they realized they made a mistake. To some degree, you can probably try to reintegrate them. But the problem with de-radicalization is we think of how do we moderate this person? How do we give this person security and comfort and a job and make them feel like life is good? The problem is that's exactly what these people were running away from. Many of these people are activists. They're idealist activists. They went to different places to give their life for a greater cause. And we're not funneling that passion and that energy necessarily into something else, something pro-social, something peaceful, something that's good for society. We're basically just saying, here's your job, be quiet, sit in the corner, and don't harm anyone. Well, next time there's a big conflict happening somewhere in the world, if this person hasn't found a passion right here locally, they can go join that group. And so that's, I think, the big missing element of de-radicalization right now.
Does this mean, though, that those who've been radicalized are lost?
Not all of them. I think there are some people who really are lost, who are so deeply entrenched in their beliefs that we need to quarantine them from society. And that's going to depend on every country.
You do think that things like Guantanamo are justified?
No, not necessarily.
Put them away?
Not necessarily. I mean, some people, for example, when you put radicalized people in prison, you can put them in solitary confinement, so that way they're not interacting with the general population and radicalizing them. Other people, when you put them back into society, and put them in probation, for example, and limit their amount of movements and the time they spend outside their homes and the kind of people that they can be communicating with, so that way, again, they're not interacting with vulnerable communities. So there's ways of being able to quarantine people that doesn't violate their civil liberties at all. But a lot of people, I think, can be disengaged, and their passions can be then rechanneled into other areas. But again, that's going to have to be a local effort. Every country for themselves has to figure out what are the passions of people in this country? What are the sentiments? What are the grievances? What are the things that their radicalized people are being attracted by? And this is another criticism that I would have about governments, is once people come back, they have interrogators, usually police or intelligence interrogators, who get information out of this person that can be used for operational benefits and ultimately to help prosecute that person. But once that person is in jail, they pretty much leave them alone and they don't really talk to them. And here you have this person who not only is a goldmine of information that can be useful in terms of building prevention programs or other de-radicalization programs, but is also probably going to tell you exactly what you need to know in order to make sure that they don't join one of these groups again. And those people are not being communicated with, not being engaged with. So I think until we actually start talking to these people, not for the purposes of interrogation, not for the purposes of prosecution, but just for the purposes of understanding, we're going to remain a little bit lost.
What about all the fake news that we're seeing now? Some postulate that actually this helps to radicalize people, and that possibly people who are radicalized are perhaps more gullible than the norm.
So we actually wanted to test this systematically. So we tested for what's called conspiracy ideation, people's propensity to believe in conspiracy theories. And we found no correlation between radicalization and people's propensity to believe in conspiracy theories. In fact, people who are not radicalized have their own conspiracy theories that they believe about these groups. So, for example, one of the most common things I hear is how ISIS is created by the CIA, or how Al-Qaeda was created by Mossad or some Indian intelligence agency. There was an article that went viral a couple of years ago about Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, that he was supposedly a Mossad agent. He was an Israeli intelligence agent, and he's actually a Jewish guy. And they showed pictures of some supposedly Jewish intelligence agent from Mossad and Baghdadi, and everyone was believing in it. So conspiracies and fake news and believing in mythologies in order to make you want to support your own beliefs and to maintain your own beliefs, that's everyone is vulnerable to that.
So in other words, that the radicalized person, a terrorist, is not more gullible than the rest of us, so to say, because we're also gullible, as it were, to fake news.
Exactly. And in fact, one of the techniques that's used to be able to manipulate someone and sort of pull them into a radical group, and this is also true for, again, right-wing nationalist groups in Europe, is to say, look, everyone believes in this sort of standard narrative about you know what's going on in the world. But here's some information that you didn't know. And oftentimes what they're sharing with them is actually accurate information. It's accurate statistics about economic issues or geopolitical issues that can be verified. In fact, there was a colleague of mine who did some research looking at the computer hard drives of people who eventually joined a terrorist group to look at what was this person consuming in the early stages of their radicalization. They weren't just consuming the propaganda from a particular group. They were actually verifying that propaganda to see if it was actually true on the BBC, on CNN, on academic articles. They were actually looking to see the veracity of these claims. And once they sort of bought into this organization's propaganda and said, what they're saying is actually at least partially true, and it's not as that these ideas are not as much out there as you would normally see, then they slowly start consuming the propaganda exclusively of that particular group.
What about you personally? Interestingly, you were quasi, so to say, involved in an actual terrorist incident on the very famous shopping street in Barcelona, Les Ramblas. You were some blocks away, so you weren't actually affected directly, but you saw the people running away from this van which had rammed in and killed 13 persons. Has this changed your perspective on what you do? Has made it a little bit more personal?
On an emotional level, sure. I mean, when I was there and I turned around and I saw all these people running, immediately I knew what had happened, you know? And it was, my mind went in so many different directions. I mean, immediately it was just to run and get out of there. And then it was like this day that I had hoped would never come actually came to fruition. The second thought I had, the thought after that that I had was, I hope this wasn't someone that I actually talked to and someone that I know, which is very possible. I mean, I spend time with these kinds of groups and these kinds of people. And then I just think I was just very, very sad when I saw, you know, the people bloodied and hurt. And I think I spent so much time with the perpetrators of these acts, and I haven't spent enough time with the victims of these acts. And then to see the victims, not a month or 2 months later, but to see their bloodied bodies being pulled out of that street, brought a sense of urgency to my work in that moment that I hadn't felt as much before.